have been watching this ongoing interaction between Job and his three friends. The three friends all have it pretty good at the time that the story takes place. They're comfortable, successful, they're healthy, and they're also religious and moral. So they talk about God a lot, but they have completely misunderstood God's real nature. And so even though they're moral and even though they're religious, they're very much at odds with God, completely at odds with God. They don't even realize that they have a problem, and they're so sure of themselves that they're offended at Job when he points out that they do have a problem. These men thought that they could work to produce righteousness for themselves and that God would accept that as being good enough to satisfy his wrath over sin. They really just missed who God is. They missed what sin is. They missed what wrath is. And they grossly overestimated their ability to produce anything that God would want from them. They didn't know God at all. On the other hand, Job is in a terrible situation in his life. We saw that unfold in the first two chapters. He's broken in poverty. He's grieving the death of all 10 of his children. And he's suffering from an absolutely horrific disease. And yet Job is the one who does know God. He has more than just a human moral code with God thrown in for spice. He really gets it. God himself has declared Job to be the most righteous person alive in that generation. He understood. And so everything kind of seems out of place. It's discordant somehow that the righteous one is suffering horribly and the ones who are unrighteous, self-righteous, offensive to God, have got it so good. They're comfortable. Everything's going well for them, going along in oblivious self-assurance. Certainly seemed out of whack to Job. He's complained about it a good bit. He's spent a lot of time asking why. He's even asked God to justify his actions. He wants an answer to this. And maybe you've been there. Most of us have been there. Wondering why God is doing it the way he's doing it. Why he's letting this happen. Why he's causing that thing to happen. Why isn't there an immediate, tangible payoff for me if I do good? Why does God allow his children to suffer? Why does he let those that he loves go on hurting? How can you be bereaved of loved ones if God approves of your life? How are these things possible? If being righteous doesn't produce that immediate payoff so that everything goes well for you, you get to be rich and healthy and everything's good, you got a long life, then what do you hope in? These tangible things are so easy to grasp a hold of. If you can't hope in that, then what? What assurance does a Christian have? Well, our text for the day, for today is going to broach some of those things and answer many of those kinds of questions. Let's look together at Job chapter 19, beginning with verse 7. This is where we left off 2 weeks ago when I was last here. Job chapter 19, beginning with verse 7. We'll read through the end of the chapter. Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has put darkness on my paths. He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And he has uprooted my hope like a tree. He has also kindled his anger against me and considered me as his enemy. His troops come together and build up their way against me and camp around my tent. He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. Those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger. I am a foreigner in their sight. I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even young children despise me. I rise up and they speak against me. All my associates abhor me, and those I love have turned against me. My bone clings to my skin and my flesh, and I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. Pity me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God and are not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find, then be afraid of the sword for yourselves. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is judgment. Now this is part of Job's response to the second speech of the friend named Bildad. We looked at the first part of that speech 2 weeks ago when we were together. Job had pointed out to Bildad and for the others that even if they succeeded in knocking him down, and even if they managed to prove his guilt, that fact would still not establish them as righteous. That fact, even if Job was wrong, as they said, and even if they knocked him all the way down and proved it where no one could argue it, it still wouldn't make them right with God. It's a very salient point to make. You can't be higher by pulling someone else lower, and he pointed that out to them. He reminded them in the process that there was something missing from their system of religion, and that the something that was missing was God himself. They talked about God, they had God words in their lingo, but practically, in the way they lived out their religion, there was no place for God at all. It was all about them and what they could do and what they could produce and how content they were with it and how satisfied they were that they had produced something worthwhile. And God didn't really fit anywhere in it except that his name was tossed in occasionally. These guys had failed to notice that God is actively working in history, that God places one person above another, one nation above another. He puts somebody high, he puts somebody else low. They don't have any concept of that in their religion. They failed to recognize that God is working his purposes in this world all the time, and that it's not just what you do, and then there's this spiritual force that makes you get good or bad as a result. There's more to it than that. So Job began his response by pointing out this flaw in their religion, and they all three agreed on that part of religion. And then Job lapses back into this complaining that we just read. His situation was so incredibly hard, and he's struggling and hurting so much. He's very upfront about his struggle, which I think helps us. He's not holding back. Many of you have been in situations like that where you've hurt very badly, and you've asked questions like Job asks, and you've wondered why he's mad at you, and you've wondered why he's sending his forces against you, and these things that Job brings up, you've felt that way. Most of us have. Wondering if you'll ever be able to bear it. Struggling with it because it seems too much, and it seems completely out of proportion to any mistakes you've ever made, and it seems so unfair compared to how those ungodly people seem so comfortable all the time, and you wonder what is going on. Going through that can be incredibly hard. Now, we do have a tremendous advantage as we look at Job's story that Job didn't have, and that we have a lot of information that he never got. Job never read those first couple of chapters where we get the whole idea of what's going on and that God is the one orchestrating it and that he very clearly is pointing toward a purpose for good. He had no idea that he was going to become the example for the rest of history of enduring and suffering, of trusting God, of God accomplishing his purpose in you, whether you understand it or not, whether you like it or not. He didn't get any of that. And so you and I, as we read this story, have a tremendous advantage in that we can see that there is purpose in the suffering of a believer. There is purpose in the suffering of a believer. In verses 7 through 12, look at them again. This is Job's very poignant complaint. "Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there's no justice. He has walled up my ways so that I cannot pass. He has put darkness on my paths. He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And he has uprooted my hope like a tree. He has also kindled his anger against me and considered me as his enemy. His troops come together and build up their way against me and camp around my tent." Now, Job doesn't get it quite like he ought to get it. God is not his enemy. God is not treating him as an enemy, but he thinks that. What we need to realize, that Job realizes later, is that even when it feels that way, there is a purpose when God allows his children to suffer. And Job is complaining that God is doing this to him and that there's nothing that Job can do to stop it. And that much is absolutely true. God is doing it. No matter what system of theology you hold to, just go back another step or maybe another step after that, and you still get back to a God who made it this way. You insert anything you want to insert about free will and all of your rights to choose and all of that, fine. Go back one more step, and you'll still find a God who created a system in which you could do that. Ultimately, it has to go back to him. He did it. He made it where you could do that. He made it where it could happen this way. He sent something into your life, and you can't do anything about it. Job recognizes that much that many people miss. There's nothing he can do to put this train on another track. He's just along for the ride. What we know that Job can't see yet is that God is doing all of this for God's glory and for Job's good. God is glorified as Job bears up under suffering, demonstrating a faith that had to come from outside of himself. It proves that God put something in Job that couldn't be quenched. And in the process, Job is improved as he learns to look to God, and finally, by the end of the book, to humble himself and rest in God. In the life of a believer, struggling and suffering and hardship are just a way of reaching a whole new understanding of who God is and how you must relate to him. This is one of the purposes that God was working through Job's situation. Because his faith was real, it stood the test. He keeps turning to God. You notice even in this bitter complaint that he's going to God with it. If he's complaining, he's complaining about God. He's complaining to God. He cannot think of the world in the way that Bildad and Eliphaz and Zophar do. The three friends can think of the world as only human. It's what you do, and it's what I do, and it's what that guy over there does, and God somehow enters into it right at the last, and we go into heaven if he likes what we did. Job can't even conceptualize the world that way. Everything puts him back to God. Why? God, what are you doing? God let up on me a little bit, but always it's God. He cannot escape the reality that God is in control, and that God is doing something, and he doesn't understand it, and so he keeps turning to God. These other guys have such a simplistic system where it's all about them. It doesn't hold up. It doesn't work. God's nowhere in it. Job at least knows that God is acting in his life, and as he grapples with what's going on, he eventually comes to a whole new understanding of God, and that is one of the purposes. God has stripped Job of everything else: his wealth, his family, his comforts, his earthly pursuits, his health. It's all gone. Even the most basic comforts are denied him. He's already repeatedly said how food is odious to him. You know, it's supposed to be a pleasure and a comfort and a blessing, and it just makes him worse. All of the comforts of life are gone. And he's particularly aware at this point in the process of the impossibility of any natural human interaction. Think about how important this is, and then think about what Job is going through. And beginning in verse 13, And he's saying, now God did all of this. And he's right. God did all of this. Here's what he says. He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. Those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger. I'm a foreigner in their sight. I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife, and I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even young children despise me. I rise up, and they speak against me. All my associates abhor me, and those I love have turned against me. There's an artificial distance between Job and every other living human being that he can interact with. His brothers, all the rest of his family, all of his acquaintances, all of his friends, even his servants now treat him with disdain. They won't even answer him. Even small children. We were on the beach all week and everybody comes over to talk to Sarah. There's nothing for a conversation piece like a two-year-old. Except with him. The small children disdained him. They wouldn't even talk to him. They talked against him. They thought he was gross. They had to get away. All of Job's life now is characterized by this artificial distance between him and every other living person. There's separation. No one can be depended on. Everyone has forgotten him, or he's alienated from them. They haven't forgotten him. They just don't want any part of him. It's like a living death for him. Nobody can stand to be around him or to look at him or smell him because of this disease that he has. You may have noticed how much people crave interaction with other people. Even the most poorly adjusted people in our society love to be around other people. Even in their worst moments, they want to be around somebody just to pick a fight with them, just to have some way to interact with another human being. The worst of the worst, at their worst, do something with somebody else, even if it's just fight. Even the vilest people on the planet seem to find friends, don't they? Every society, even within a prison, even among the very worst offenders, they pair off. They get into groups. They have, this is us and that's them, but we're going to relate to each other. No matter how low the standard, people find someone else to share it with them. You need that. It's part of life, but not for this guy. It's all gone. Job can't have any interaction with anybody because nobody can stand him. His disease has made him disgusting to be around, horrible to smell, horrible to look at. It's not that he needs to work on his people skills. There's nothing he can do about this. God has done it to him, and Job can't do anything to change it. This has been forced on him. And he longs at least to have some compassion from his three closest friends. Asks for it again, but doesn't get it. Verse 20, my bone clings to my skin, my flesh, and I have escaped only by the skin of my teeth. Pity me, O you my friends, for the Lord, the hand of God has struck me. He says, why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? He doesn't get the pity he longs for. Even that would be some kind of human interaction, and the guys are like, I don't know, man. Now, if God sends this into your life, is there hope? Even if it's not as bad as this, but it seems like all you can stand, what are you hoping? In that kind of misery, what would you do with this guy? If you're the social worker and you get sent to see this guy, would it be better maybe to numb him with medications that stupefy him to the point that he can't think clearly enough to be upset? Would that be an improvement over his condition? Something approaching 100% of the medical community would say, yeah, that's better. Would it be better to give him dignity in death? Perhaps have our government step up and offer assisted suicide to say that this man deserves dignity in dying and that really, he shouldn't have to endure such pain, and maybe we should just kill him now. What do you do? What do you do with this? I mean, this is a real, real life situation that happens all the time and that everybody in our society is trying to address with something. What's the Christian answer to this? Is there any hope from where Job is? What are you and I to think? Well, there is hope. God is doing something valuable in the life of His child. Job is not undergoing meaningless suffering. Job does not need to be put into oblivion by medications or into eternity by some form of contrived death. It would not be better for someone to help him die. There would never be more dignity in dying than there would be in enduring what God had sent into a person's life. For a believer, there is purpose, even in something as radical as this, especially in this sort of thing. For Job, God has stripped away everything else that people look to and depend upon and hope in, so that at the end of this long progression, Job is going to come to a new understanding of God. He's going to see God much more clearly. He's going to trust God much more fully. This is an objective so valuable that the perfect, holy God is willing to inflict all of this on Job in order to bring about the objective. This is a purpose that is so high that God is willing to go to these lengths to bring that purpose about in Job's life. And it's a purpose that God wants you to embrace, to understand. There is a purpose. If God lets something, when God sends something into your life that you don't like, if you're a believer in Him, you can always know there is a purpose. It relates to your knowledge of God, your walk with Him, your ability to trust Him. Whatever else it always does that, and you can have hope and you can trust Him. There is tremendous irony in the next words that Job utters. Look at verse 23. Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. He had no idea. He had no idea. He's just hurting really bad. And he cries out, well, it would at least be better if people could know this. With no idea that the God of all glory had purposed from before the foundations of the world to put His story in something far more permanent than any rock that could be written on with an iron stylus. God's doing a work in this man's life. And He put it down so you can know. And what you can know is that God will accomplish His purpose in the lives of His children at any cost. It's worth any price. And that God knows just what to do in each individual life to bring about that purpose. If you belong to Him and He's doing something in your life that you don't understand and that you don't like, I want you today to take tremendous hope and encouragement in Job's example to us. God put it down for that purpose. There's nothing in your life more important than your knowing God and knowing Him more and more and resting in Him and trusting Him. There's nothing more important than that. And God is going to do in you whatever He has to do to bring about this great purpose. He knows your frame. He knows what you can take. He knows what you need. And your life will be a tremendous mixture of good and bad, of pleasure and pain. God will know just how to put it together for you to bring about His purpose in you. There'll be times when God will send things that are so painful that you don't think you can bear it. And when He does, you can remember the words that God wrote down in a more permanent place than a rock. You can remember that he does it because he loves you, and that because he always accomplishes the best for his children. He's going to do in you what he has already purposed to do. And at the end of it, it'll be good. If you're his. Job is struggling, but there's purpose in the struggle. I want you also to see in this text that even in suffering, there is hope in the believer. There's purpose in the suffering, and there's hope in the believer. Even at the very bottom, there's an unassailable hope that everyone who genuinely trusts God for salvation will always have. Look at verse 25. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I will see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see and not another. My heart faints within me. Many people today like to talk of the ancients as if they were primitive in their theology. Many theologians speak of Old Testament theology in general and of Job in particular because it's such an old story, as if it's somehow lacking in well-developed theology. I think maybe it comes from believing in evolution or from the influence on our society of evolution, that they think that people who lived 4,000 years ago must have been closer to primordial soup, maybe, than we are. And the truth is, you had to be a lot sharper to live in that environment than some of us with our comforts necessarily have to be. From Adam and Eve, we have been human. Everybody's kind of been the same. We're not smarter than they were. Maybe a little more comfortable right now, but certainly not smarter. And this theology in Job is well-developed theology. And these verses right here ought to put that foolishness to rest, if it just even just these. In the middle of his suffering, with all of his dignity taken away, with all of his human comforts taken away, with all of his friends and family turning away, even strangers despising him, Job has a hope in the resurrection, and it's a great comfort to him. With everything else gone from his life, he has this much. Job is absolutely certain of a literal, physical, individual, conscious resurrection from the dead that depends on a personal redeemer. All of that in these verses. Pretty good theology course just right here. First part of verse 25, he says, "As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives." It should be very reassuring to us that Job is able to maintain this kind of hope in the midst of terrible suffering. God is doing a work in his life and his faith stays. But I want you to note where his faith lies. It's not, you know, it's all going to turn out okay. Everybody goes through hard times and, you know, it's going to turn up for you one day. Things will get better. It's not, well, you know, it could be a lot worse. Count your blessings. Where's his hope lie? It's in someone else, isn't it? I know that my Redeemer lives. It's because a Redeemer lives. It's because of personal redemption accomplished by the actions of another that Job has hope. And he believes that the one who accomplishes it lives. Now, the Hebrew word here for redeemer is literally kinsman. This is the ancient concept of the kinsman redeemer that we looked at in the book of Ruth a few months ago. By law, in many of those ancient cultures in the East, not only could a close relative redeem a person out of financial trouble or supply an heir for a deceased close relative by taking the widow as a wife, but that close relative had a responsibility to do so. It was considered shameful if a close relative had the opportunity, had the means to help and wouldn't help. That was a terrible thing to do. It was a shameful thing to do. Job believed in a redeemer who had a vested interest in his life, a near association, one who had the right and the responsibility to step in and save him out of his trouble, one to whom he was closely related, one who had an interest. When Job expresses this amazing hope, he's not talking about something that's related to this world. Look at the rest of verse 25. It says, "And at the last, he will take his stand on the earth." At the last, at the end of everything else on the earth, this Redeemer is going to return in power and take his stand on the earth. Even at the lowest point of his life, Job knows this and hopes in this, because there's a Redeemer who has a personal interest in Job. Then in verse 26, he says, "Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God." Now, after his skin is destroyed has to be after death, right? And then he says, from his flesh he's going to see God. Now, Job's no idiot. He knows that things rot when they're dead, including people. You go back to the dirt. And yet he says, after that, I'm going to see God in the flesh. This can be nothing but a bodily resurrection. The words don't make sense to mean anything else. Job knows that at the last, when the Redeemer stands, Job will be raised up to see him in his flesh, and that he's going to have a body. And then in verse 27, he says, "Whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another, my heart faints within me." This is a conscious resurrection. It's a personal resurrection. He says, I'm going to see him with my eyes. I'm not going to see him with somebody else's eyes. Many religions speak of the afterlife as if it is some vague, impersonal existence, completely unlike what we know here. No personality, no individuality. They expect to be absorbed into some big, impersonal whole. And they talk about that as if it would be an improvement over personal being. But Job speaks of a personal, conscious resurrection in which every individual remains intact. There's no absorption into some great impersonal whole. There's no blending in with other people. Everybody's going to stand before God in the end. And because of the faith that God had put into Job's heart, by that miracle of salvation, Job can look forward to that day with hope and not with fear. This is a beautifully well-developed theology of the resurrection in this ancient, ancient book. We do get more information in the New Testament as it reveals that this Redeemer is Jesus Christ, that the way that he paid for our salvation is by his death on the cross, his blood shed as a substitution for the punishment that was due to us. We get a lot more information in the New Testament, but it's not different information. It's not conflicting information. Job's view of the resurrection is completely consistent with the rest of Scripture. There's a day coming when every person is going to stand before God and give an account, and those who have trusted Christ are going to see him, and their hope in him is going to be fulfilled in that day. You, think about that. Personally, individually, you're going to stand in your body after death, after the resurrection, and you're going to see the Lord of glory, and you will either have loved him and cherished him and be united with him before that happens, or you'll be standing there as his enemy. Puts anything that happens into this life in perspective, doesn't it? Job has such a walk with God that he's able to look forward to that day with confidence, even though he understands it clearly. There's no terror because he knows he's already related to this Redeemer. That's the hope that's in a believer, even in suffering. There's purpose, whether you see it or not. There's hope that'll always be there in a genuine believer. And then in this text, right at the last, we'll see that there is a message for the unbeliever. Job is down and he's in anguish, and his three friends are knocking him around pretty bad throughout this book. He's tried to help them before, which is pretty kind considering how ugly they're being. And here he gives them another challenge in these last two verses. Look at verse 28. Speaking directly to the friends now. If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find? Then be afraid of the sword for yourselves. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know there is a judgment. These guys were doing that. They were hitting Job while he was down. It was making them feel better about themselves. They had some doubts about their religion because it was pretty empty. And so, you know, it always rings hollow. And they think, well, if we knock him down a little lower, we'll feel a little higher. He knows what they're doing. And so he says, I'm weak. I'm about to faint. But you guys need to understand, if you take advantage of my weakness, there is judgment. And you need to realize it's coming. Wrath brings the punishment of the sword so that you may know there is judgment. This is not the first time Job has mentioned judgment to these three men. They're not considering even now that they will be judged at the last when everyone is raised from the dead, that they're going to stand and give an account, and that the judge will be using a standard outside of them, his own standard, not their standard. For all of their lofty talk, they're not ready for a judgment. Even in his anguish, Job knows, and he's reaching out to them again, trying to get them to see their desperate need, and he's proclaiming a redeemer. Have you ever considered that you can make that proclamation if you're a believer? You can make that proclamation from any situation in life. If yours follows the path of most people's, there'll be some really good highs and there'll be some really bad lows. But from either extreme and from anywhere in the middle, you can offer this same message. This is the message of Christian hope. From comfort and privilege and great blessing, you can say, you know, in this life, it is not always this way. It will not always be like this. The good things of this world go away. And we're only going to be left with the spiritual. And we have to be ready to give an account to the one who is going to rule in eternity. You can say that no matter how rich you are. And from horrible suffering, just as Job, you can also say, you know what, it will not always be this way. You might have to give yourself that talk sometimes. It's not always going to be this way. Not like it is in this world. This suffering is temporary. This low position for me is temporary. But there's coming a judgment. And after that, some are never going to suffer again. And some are going to see suffering like this world has never known. No matter what your condition in life, you can make this proclamation. No matter what your status in life, you can say this and it'll have teeth in it. Every person is going to give an account. Be afraid of the sword for yourselves. We need to say that to this world. It doesn't need to be a lot of feel-good theology. God loves you. God has a wonderful plan for your life. God might be really mad at them. Tell them about the sword. Can give that message. You must give that message to be of any help to them. Well, if you've wondered why you go through some of the things you go through, there's a lot in chapter 19 to keep it in perspective, isn't there? If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, it's the same for you. Maybe not this drastic, but it's the same. There's a purpose in what you go through. God is doing something in your life for your good. There's hope in you. If you really know Him, nothing ever takes that completely away. You may doubt, you may waver, you may struggle, you may cry out to God, why, oh, why are you doing this to me? But always, if you're a believer, there'll be some underlying evidence of salvation. You'll still hope in Him. Even when you whine, you'll be whining to Him. You won't be able to think of life as anything where God doesn't exist. There's a purpose for you. There's hope in you, and there's a message that you have for this world. If you don't have that hope, you can't produce it in yourself. That's why God sent His Son to die on the cross, to give you that hope. You just embrace what He has done. You believe that He died on the cross, that that's enough to pay for all of your sins, and you cry out for His mercy and He saves. Jesus is this Redeemer that Job mentioned in this text. He is going to return in power. For some, that day of the Lord is going to be a horrible, rude awakening. Jesus warned over and over again about it. People saying, "Lord, Lord," to Him, and He says, "Away from me, I never knew you," and they're going to be cast out where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Tim warned about it this morning in the Sunday school hour. Don't let it happen to you. Don't miss it. Here's the hope. Don't miss it. Make peace with Him while there's time. For the vast majority in this room, we have this hope. We need to carry this message. Even when we're hurting and they're beating on us some more, we need to have the kind of integrity that Job has to warn them yet again. Knowing they're probably going to hit you again when you do, warn them anyway. It's right. It glorifies God. It's the way to love them. This is our message. There is a sword. There is a judgment. They need to get ready. The word saved doesn't mean anything until you know there's something to be saved from. So you have to have some of that in your message. Wrath brings the punishment of the sword so that you may know that there is judgment. Sounds pretty negative, but it is the path to hope, and that's our message. Bow with me in prayer.